Hey everyone, my name is Dr. Brittany Simone, and welcome to the first installment of Pipettes to Patients, a podcast focused on how research moves from the earliest stages in the lab to clinical trials involving patients. I am a radiation oncologist here at Upstate Medical University, and I'm also what's termed a physician scientist. That means that I have a really cool position where I get to treat patients and perform cancer research in the laboratory to help move the needle in cancer care right here in central New York. I am passionate about how new and improved treatments make their way from preclinical research to clinical research and beyond. We have a wealth of amazing research happening right here at Upstate, and I'm really excited to be able to share it with all of you. Before we get into it, I do want to give you a little bit more background as to what exactly preclinical research entails. So think of it like a test drive for a new car. Before the car actually hits the market, it goes through various tests to ensure that it's safe and operates as expected. Similarly, preclinical research helps ensure that a new treatment is ready for the next step, which is testing it in people during clinical trials. It's an essential part of the process to make sure that any new medical treatment is both safe and effective before it reaches patients. So, in honor of National Brain Tumor Awareness Month, which is May, as well as National Cancer Research Month, I wanted to highlight a few facts about central nervous system tumors. About 25,000 people in the United States will be diagnosed with cancerous tumors of the brain or spine this year, and central nervous system tumors represent 1.4% of all cancers. Usually when we talk about brain tumors, we separate them into primary or secondary brain tumors. A primary brain tumor is one that started in the brain tissue, and a secondary brain tumor is one that has traveled to the brain from a cancer somewhere else in the body. As far as primary brain tumors go, glioblastoma is the most common and is also the most deadly form of a primary brain tumor. This type of cancer requires collaboration from a neurosurgeon, a radiation oncologist, and a neuro-oncologist or medical oncologist to provide the best possible treatment for patients. So in that same vein, I was able to bring together Dr. Michael Mix, a fellow radiation oncologist, and Dr. Mariano Villapiano, an associate professor in the neuroscience and physiology department, for a wonderful episode of Pipettes to Patients. So I'm here with Dr. Mariano Villapiano, who is an associate professor of neuroscience and physiology. He is also the director of the Brain Tumor Repository, which is amazing, here at Upstate. And I also have my colleague and friend, Dr. Michael Mix, who is an associate professor of radiation oncology. So thank you guys so much for agreeing to be part of this first episode of the podcast. So May is National Brain Tumor Awareness Month, and so I thought it was pretty apropos to try and get you guys together in the same room and talk about some of the research that happens at Upstate with regard to central nervous system tumors. What is one common misconception that people have about your job? Mariano, go ahead.
I would actually say probably two misconceptions. I'm a basic scientist. I run a laboratory that actually works with together with clinicians, but most of the time we are the lab guys, the basic science guys. And two common misconceptions is the time scale that it takes for research to be completed. We are not at all like CSI Miami or anything else that you can see in the TV. And second, the cost for academic research of the type of research that we do. And when you go to academic laboratories, we are very unassuming, a few benches and some equipment here and there and people in lab coats doing research. But we actually put a lot of energy on what we do, and we want patients and clinicians that work with us to understand that we are really very, very committed to what we are doing, but time scale and cost scale are very different to what people might think about us.
Mike, I'm going to roll over to you at this point. So what do you think is one common misconception that people have about your job?
Yeah, first I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here. I think it's really a great way to bring awareness to brain tumor research and ways in which we're all trying to work together to take better care of these patients. So I think the biggest misconception about my job being a radiation oncologist, and you can identify with this, I'm sure, as a fellow radiation oncologist, is that I think there's a bit of a lack of understanding about what it is we do. Right. Even some people in my own family will confuse my profession with other similarly named medical professions. Right.
So radiology.
That's right. So we're radiation oncologists, which means we use radiation in various forms to treat cancers and other benign conditions. And it's a really powerful tool that has evolved immensely over the last several decades. And so I would just make sure that everybody knows when they hear about radiation treatment, whether it's used for brain tumors or for other cancers or conditions, that it's not the same as the radiation that, you know, you or someone you know had 40 years ago. And the technology and the understanding that we have now is so powerful and so much different than before that we can really use it as an extremely important part of the multidisciplinary management of these tumors. So I would make sure that that message got out if I have the chance, which it seems like I do.
you have a hot mic in front of
that's
you.
Right.
So,
that's right.
You know, you got it. So speaking of multidisciplinary care, you know, with glioblastoma in particular, right, which is a very aggressive primary brain tumor, it really requires collaboration between lots of specialties. So what exactly is it about glioblastoma or brain tumors in general that really fascinates both of you? Because it wouldn't be my first choice to treat this, but you guys love it. So tell me why.
You know, to me, I was always drawn to tumors in the central nervous system and wanted to make that a primary focus of my career. Number one, because there's so much work to be done, right? While there have been a lot of there's been a lot of positive momentum in therapy over the last few decades, there's still so much work to be done, and it can be such a devastating illness that I think being involved in the care of these patients, even when it's very challenging for them and their families, is a privilege that I take very seriously. And making sure that we're doing the best that we can for them is just so important. And so that's number one. And number two would be, as I mentioned, radiation therapy can be such a powerful and precise tool. And there's no better example than that, than radiation therapy in the brain or radiosurgery in the brain, which is the use of intense, very focused radiation treatments where, as everybody would understand, the utmost accuracy is required with treatment in the brain. And sort of that challenge was always something that I was drawn to.
So I'm going to pick up from one word that Mike says that I also identify very much with, which is challenge. And for basic scientists like me, people that come from the bench, basically from other fields that are not even clinical fields. I am a neuroscientist by training. I have been studying for many years the development of the brain. That was my research. And I started studying brain tumors when I came here to United States in 2001, specifically because I wanted to learn more about these tumors because I found them a challenge in the field of neuroscience. I was very interested in the molecular biology and the properties. The challenge of understanding the molecular and biology and genetics of the tumor became the challenge of finding better therapies and helping patients and doing research that is meaningful for the community, that I can essentially think about whether and this is the way in which we can advance therapies and we can advance treatments.
And how do you, how do you really collaborate with clinicians, right? So you've got this amazing lab and you can make all the discoveries in the world, mm-hmm. but you need to move it to the clinic. So how do you sort of bridge that gap here at Upstate?
That's a great question. It's usually one of the most difficult aspects of a research scientist to do, to connect in a meaningful way with the clinicians and with the clinical scenario and with the patients. And actually, Upstate in several ways makes that easier than other institutions. in part because it's not as large as other institutions, and that allows me to essentially walk into the office, and sometimes I do walk into the offices of neurosurgeons and radiation oncologists and neurologists, and start talking about the clinical case that has been discussed that particular week, or the patient that arrived to the emergency department that the day before. It's also a very welcoming environment, what we do in brain cancer, that basic scientists are welcome to be part of that audience when clinical cases are discussed, and we actually have a voice where we can talk about molecular studies and so on that can be added for better treatment.
Very cool. Mike, how, you know, sometimes I think we do get a little siloed in our department. You know, it used to be that radiation oncologists lived in the basement. Actually, at Upstate, we're on the first floor.
That's so. Right. We've got skylights, a lot of natural sunlight. It's a wonderful
progress.
Place to be.
We've moved up. We've moved up. So how do you see us maybe doing a better job of bridging this gap between, you know, basic science and clinical research?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I one of the things that I was thinking about when Mariano was speaking was seeing Mariano on our tumor board conversations, right? So a tumor board, for everyone who, you know, for those of you who don't know or haven't heard, is a situation where all of the clinicians, so the neurosurgeons, the radiation oncologists, the pathologists, all the other doctors get together to discuss clinical cases, whether they're routine or they're complicated. And sometimes, as you pointed out, there's not an easy answer, or the challenges in front of us with these challenging cancers present themselves. And so the idea that you're there listening to these clinicians going on about how to treat this particular patient could very well spawn the next idea in your mind that turns into the next project in your lab and ultimately influences care in the future. Like, what a cool thing, right? It's like that idea of inception, that this one little thing from a patient conversation can ultimately be taken from the tumor board into your mind and then to your lab. And so I think the way we do better is to have follow-up conversations from these situations and say, these things have been brought up, you know, let's have meetings and let's talk about these concepts to take it one step further. To make sure that we're not missing out on those opportunities.
What do you think, you know, are the biggest hurdles in GBM research today, or glioblastoma research? I there are a lot of them, obviously, but what do you think are some of the biggest?
Yeah, I think that, well, that's a tough question, Dr. Simone. So I think there's the challenges are profound, right? This is, as you noted before, this is a very challenging diagnosis, often comes with a somewhat limited prognosis. And so there are, you know, relatively few opportunities to intervene or to deviate from the standard of care. And so I think that's one. Mariano kind of alluded to the challenges with funding and limitations that the researchers face with funding additional research ideas. And in terms of challenges with glioblastoma in particular, it is just a very tricky disease. It's a disease that we have a hard time visualizing on our conventional imaging techniques, whether it's MRIs, CAT scans, PET scans. It's something that we have trouble delineating with radiation. And all of these question marks at each step of the way make it very hard to know which approach should be the next big question for research. That's a clinician's point of view, at least.
It's an excellent point of view. Yeah, we know that there will be tumor cells that have invaded the brain a little bit beyond the margins of the wound, but we don't know exactly where they are going to come back, if they are going to come back. And that is a huge challenge for a radiation oncologist that has to decide what else, how much can we treat, how much can we prevent. It's a huge a challenge for the surgeon themselves, that they need to decide, are these the margins of the tumor that I'm going to try to resect, or should I try to resect a little bit more? This is the brain that we are talking about at the end. So you cannot just go and just take parts as you wish. I'm incredibly fortunate that to work directly with pathologists and with neurosurgeons, where the actual tumor that is resected with consent from the patient come to our laboratory, where we can do molecular analysis and we can do molecular tests and we can predict a lot of features of the tumor, but we don't know if those features might be the same as the ones in tumor cells that might have remained in the brain, or how they are going to evolve, how are they going to change over time. One of the things that Mike and I and neurologists have been advocating at the tumor board has been we need a lot more molecular profiling, more molecular studies done in the tumors. And we really want here at Upstate, and we are actually working towards that every the ideal scenario, every patient that comes with a case of glioblastoma and the tumor is biopsy is taken out, that we do a huge amount of molecular work to try to characterize that particular tumor and try to identify the best treatment for that tumor.
So you mentioned something interesting, and I want to ask, with an unlimited amount of funding, space, all of that stuff, that's important for research, if you had the opportunity to, could you take tumors from patients and actually grow them on a mouse and test new therapies to see whose tumor responds to what? And do you think that would be something that's helpful?
Oh, it is. It is very helpful. And in fact, we already do that. And of course, as you mentioned, we'll have to have a lot more funding than the one that we have because it is a very expensive procedure. But we do. We have established a very nice pipeline at SUNY Upstate that allows a basic science laboratory like mine to go to the operating room. Again, this is all consented and appropriately approved by the university, by patients, etc. Collect the biopsy of the tumor, bring it back quickly to the laboratory. We can grow the tumor cells and implant them in animals, in mice, and test them. We can divide the tumor cells in what we call lab on a chip, a laboratory on a chip, in essentially the size of a tissue slide, where we can actually put a lot of cells in there and treat them with many, many different conditions, and essentially try to find the ones that will be more efficient. The big difficulty for that research, which is basic research, is always to have a good idea of how much we can transport this back to the clinics. Will the things that I did on the bench in my laboratory, will that help the neurologist and the radiation oncologist and the surgeon? And that is usually the major challenge for a basic scientist.
Mike, you know, obviously, we're not surgeons, so we're not taking tissue, but we do put patients on clinical trials, right? So we do get that opportunity to kind of talk to people about participating in trials. How do you approach, you know, patients in terms of explaining a trial to them, or, you know, what do you see as maybe the benefits of being a participant on a clinical trial?
For me, the most important thing is patient understanding. I think it starts and ends with that, because when patients don't quite understand what the purpose of the research is or how it may affect them versus a future patient, I think that's a huge limitation. And so for me, whenever I'm talking about the standard treatment that we offer versus opportunities for clinical research, the most important thing is understanding what the aim of the research is, what the patient might gain from it, hypothetically or in real time, and then what the hope of the research is moving forward. I am constantly impressed by how many patients in our clinic have the noble drive to want to help patients who will come after them. Oftentimes, they recognize that the research they participate in won't necessarily impact their care in a huge way, but they know that they may be taking part in something that's larger than them. And so making sure the patients understand that part of it but don't feel that part is overtaking their own care, I think, is the very careful balance, because they certainly deserve the best possible care we can give them right this minute, with maybe just a small eye on the future for where we're going, because patients really get motivated by that prospect, I think. Just today I was talking with a patient who had a recent diagnosis of a tumor like this, and she was so motivated about what she could do to help her condition, right? What were the research opportunities at Upstate or elsewhere? So it is something we're always talking with them about. And as you said, it really is a special patient population that we have the privilege to take care of.
Yeah. So you mentioned, that the patient you saw was very motivated to try and figure out if there was anything she could do on her end. One of the things that patients ask me a lot, you know, is there anything in terms of their diet that they can change? You know, are there's talk of ketogenic diet, mm-hmm. right? What do you tell patients when they ask you that?
Yeah, it can be a very challenging thing to navigate because, as I said, I think it's really important to emphasize how important that self-advocacy is. And when a patient is trying to do research and wanting to do the best for themselves, that's something I really try to foster. So I encourage patients to do their own research, look into things, because that's a powerful thing for patients and it's something that brings them a lot of comfort. That said, there's a lot of education that we can do for them also about what the status of the current research is, what is the standard of care, and what things may or may not be beneficial. So my goal is always to balance my conversations with patients about both the standard treatments that we offer as well as what are the best ways to integrate other things and highlight which of them may be promising, which of them still need more research, and even offer referrals to other clinicians, such as the integrative medicine program or second referrals at other centers that have those areas of expertise.
And I want to highlight, you know, one of the areas where you both have a little bit of crossover. So, we use radiation to treat glioblastomas, right? And Mariano, you are looking at a few different things in your lab related to radiation sensitivity, right? Mm-hmm. So, Mike, can you just, in layman's terms, explain, you know, what does radiation sensitivity mean?
And so, of course, our goal with radiation is to kill the cancer cells so that they don't grow back, which means the cancer won't recur or spread or do the things we don't want it to do. But it turns out that different cancers from different organs, so breast cancer, lung cancer, glioblastoma, or brain tumors, they all respond differently to radiation. Some require smaller doses of radiation, some would require higher doses of radiation. And unfortunately, some tumors, like glioblastoma, exhibit exquisite resistance or lack of sensitivity to radiation. And this is where I'm hoping Mariano's research is going to help us figure it out.
Relatively recently, only a couple of years ago, and it was a continuation of a project that we have been developing for the past 5 years. And the first time that they started doing some of these experiments, we actually were trying to kill the tumor cells in our petri dishes, in our culture dishes, with the same amount of radiation that is used for other tumor cells, and they were not dying. And I was telling the research scientists in my lab, well, you must be doing the experiment wrong. You probably are just pointing the machine in the wrong direction. And no, actually, they are resistant. They are very resistant. There are properties of brain tumor cells, which are essentially a malignant version of normal cells in the brain. There are properties that make them naturally resistant to chemical treatment and chemotherapy and to radiation treatment. And many of those properties, we are just figuring them out.
Yeah, and we should highlight that this isn't to say that the radiation and the chemotherapy and the tools that we have don't work. Because we do know that the addition of radiation and chemotherapy are effective treatments. And, you know, the majority of patients are certainly better off with those treatments than without them. But ultimately, we just don't do quite as well, even with all of these tools that we have for this tumor type, as we do in other cancers. And I think that highlights the resistance that you're articulating.
And this has been the big area, topical area of my research for many, many years. There is this ability of the tumor, it can be treated, but a tumor in the brain, it lives in what we call a microenvironment that is appropriate for them. They kind of take advantage of them. They take advantage of other cells in the brain to protect themselves even against therapy. So it becomes, at the molecular level, at the cellular level, a bit of a difficult battle because you really want to kill the tumor without damaging the rest of the brain. But the tumor is actually taking advantage of the brain tissue.
Normal cells also have a sensitivity to radiation, right? You can also damage normal tissue or immune cells with radiation. So how do you know that the cells that are going to be in there are not getting damaged by the radiation that you're trying to make the tumor more responsive to.
Oh, I think that you're probably reviewing my grant applications. Because those are the critics that I'm thinking, dumb. They're figuring this out. That's a good question. And honestly, we don't have a straight answer because you cannot intervene in a complex model, a tumor growing in the brain, and say, okay, let's take all the tumor cells aside, separate from the immune. You cannot divide. I mean, you can do it in your laboratory, in a Petri dish, in a culture dish, but not in the brain. So yes, when we treat animals that harbor tumors, that have tumors, with radiation, and then we introduce some of these engineered immune cells, and we treat with more radiation, we don't know a priori what is going to happen with those immune. Perhaps we kill our own immune cells, that the ones that we engineer, which is not good, or perhaps we make them worse. That's all research that is ongoing in the laboratory right now. This is research that is far from being brought to the clinics, but at this moment, of course. But it's research that it has a very clear pipeline of progress to the clinics. So,
for those of us who aren't bench researchers, highlight the timeline for me. I mean, if things go well, in your lab or a lab like yours, hopefully it's yours, at what point are we gonna hear about, your research impacting patient care?
That's a great question. Let's say an example in my own research. We start today studying a tumor model, and we already have developed the techniques to engineer immune cells, inject them in the animals, and the immune cells go to the tumor, kill the tumor, and the animals survive significantly longer. You have to make it compatible with, it has to be applied in patients. So when you go from a mouse that weighs an ounce to a patient that that weighs 200 pounds, there is a massive issue of scale up. And that is one of the first challenges that a basic research laboratory has. If you want to make that in the scale that it has to be introduced in patients, you need an enormous amount of money in order to be able to make that therapy available for patients. That is one of the major challenges. But let's say that you connect with industry, you start developing your chemical or genetic reagents, and you do. Then there is the entire regulatory factors. You have to get proper approval from FDA for all your preclinical studies. The first couple of years is just to make enough chemical reagent or genetic reagent that we can use it. The next 2 to 3 years is to validate that the safety is not a problem. We are asked to usually revalidate our results with additional tests. This is all determined by the Department of Health and Human Services, FDA. So I would say from the day of your best result in the lab to the day that you can initiate the clinical trials, we are looking at probably 3 to 5 years and a few million dollars in order to generate enough of the material that you need. And that is the day that you start recruiting the first patient for the first clinical trial, when you don't even know if your treatment is going to be effective in patients. You just want first to make sure that it's safe in patients. And then you have the first clinical trial that is called a phase one that can take a couple of years to do with patients. And then a much larger clinical, much more expensive clinical trial that is called a phase two, where you want to make sure that your treatment is efficient, effective in patients. It really helps patients survive longer. And then at some point, you need to do a much larger clinical trial to make sure that you are not biasing the results in any way. That is called a phase three, which is done with many institutions. At that point, you will be probably 12 years from the day that you cure your first mouse in your laboratory, and about $600 to $700 million away from there. I'm not trying to say this to discourage people from either being involved in clinical trials or in basic research, because there are many, many projects going on at the same time. We are trying many things. We want to develop something that eventually can be used for the patient population at large.
We've touched a lot about safety of trials and research. What are some of the things logistically that you think about as a clinical researcher when you're designing a new clinical trial, or even, you know, we participate in national clinical trials, right? What are some of the things that you think about when you look at trials or try to design your own trial in terms of opening them here?
Sure. So I think I want to make sure that all of the options presented are in line with the values that I've highlighted so far. So whether it's something I'm designing myself, and in our department we have things that are investigator-initiated, meaning things that are started in our own department and maybe our pilot trials that we're hoping to expand the treatment, or participation in nationwide trials, we screen them very carefully, both as clinicians ourselves and through multiple oversight groups and bodies within the cancer center to make sure that we think these are good treatment options for the patients. So I want to make sure there aren't unnecessary delays, for example, or are there extra tests or are there extra procedures that aren't necessary? And sometimes those are necessary, and patients are very willing to undergo additional tests and procedures, but we want to make sure that there's a good balance between the research and the care that we're giving. Also, we want to make sure that the options for clinical trials are ask meaningful questions for patients, right? We don't want to participate in things that are that don't aim to make big differences for patients.
Right. I think there's some sort of internal thing within all of us where we love a challenge. But it's really important to keep a balance, I think. So what are some of the things, you know, you get home after a very busy day or a hard day, seeing a lot of patients that have a devastating disease or getting a bunch of grant rejections or publication rejections, what are some of the things that you do to sort of decompress from that?
So for me, that question's easy. You know, my lovely wife, Jackie, my three kids, Harrison, McKenna, and Everett, are everything to me, and their support of me allows me to do such a good job at work. You know, every day I go home and tell my kids that it's with their support and with my wife's support that I get to be good at my job during the day. I also play the guitar once in a while, and you know, I'm a Bills fan, I'm an Orioles fan, so I find little bits of time for those things, but it's all about my family. Go Bills.
Well, first of all, I entirely have to agree with Mike on the family side. It's our professions are hard professions, our profession where you certainly want to feel that you have support at home for what you are doing. For a scientist, there is an additional thing that lets us all the time to overcome the issue of having grant rejected, having paper rejected, and that's the fact that we are a bit narcissistic in the good sense, in that, well, they didn't give me the grant, it's their loss. I'm gonna write another one, it's gonna be better. And this is actually something that you develop in a polite but consistent way. The rejection is almost a continuous background in our profession, right? It's much more common that you will have a scientific publication rejected, clinical publication rejected, and a grant rejected than being accepted. No one is going to accept it because usually it's evaluated by scientists. We are very skeptical of what you are doing. But you all the time are very convinced of what you are doing. So you say, well, if they're lost, I'll get a new one.
All right. Well, it's been a pleasure, you guys. Thank you so much for coming on the first episode of Pipettes to Patients. I hope you guys will come back again next year, maybe, with some new discoveries.
Absolutely. That'd be very nice. Thanks for having us.
So, as this first episode comes to a close, I want to highlight a few important pieces of information. Because these tumors are relatively rare, it can be difficult for patients and caregivers to find accurate information. But the National Cancer Institute has several great resources for the public, as does the American Cancer Society. If you're looking for more information, you can log on to www.cancer.gov or www.cancer.org for additional resources. If you're ever looking for information on clinical trials that may be open, you can visit www.clinicaltrials.gov to search nationwide trials that may be available in your area. Additionally, you can pop over to upstate.edu/cancer/research if you're interested in learning more about the current research that's happening right here at Upstate. Lastly, I want to thank all of the amazing patients that have participated in clinical trials here at Upstate. We could not do what we do without you. You can find links to the faculty profiles of our guests from today in the show notes, as well as additional information on clinical care here at Upstate. If you enjoyed listening in today, don't forget to follow us wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you for joining us on Pipettes to Patients, where every discovery brings us one step closer to hope. Until next time, stay informed, stay empowered.